Romero's search for investors for his first feature-length screenplay, Wine of the Fawn, ultimately failed.
Eventually, we abandoned it and decided to do, you know, maybe we should do something a little more commercial. And so we decided to do a horror thing. And I had read a novel called I Am Legend, a Richard Matheson novel. And it seemed to me that it was about revolution underneath. But we were also, you know, very aware of the time and the, you know, the sort of anger of the 60s.
The year was 1967. The U.S. was fighting an increasingly unpopular war in Vietnam. At home in the U.S., despite historic strides made during the Civil Rights era, rampant racism still ruled. After suffering continued unchecked discrimination, African Americans took to the streets. Some called it rioting. Others called it revolution.
We stand on the eve of a black revolution, brothers. Masses of our people are in the street. They're fighting tit for tat, tooth for tooth, an eye for an eye and a life for a life.
The summer of 67 was the summer of riots in Newark and Detroit, and the idea of the American ghetto really started to take hold in the public consciousness as a kind of symptom of the civil rights movement, whereas, you know, in the 50s and early 60s it would have been lunch counters and marches in southern cities and buses. Now it was about anger.
There was a good deal of sort of anger. You know, I think mostly that the 60s didn't work. You know, we thought we had changed the world or sort of, we're part of some sort of a reform that was going to, you know, make things better. And all of a sudden, it wasn't any better. It wasn't any different. So, you know, I think there was a bit of rage, a bit of disappointment. So I invented these characters, which, and in my mind, they were just ghouls. The dead are coming back to life. That's the revolution. That's the big thing that everybody is missing. We just wanted to be, you know, make as ballsy a horror film as we could make.
Well, you used to really be scared here.
Johnny!
You're still afraid. They're coming to get you, Barbara. They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
The new horror comes stumbling towards them, which is the zombie. And he really reinvents the zombie. And the zombie becomes one of the great new monsters.
The image of the zombie in the cemetery is a key image we all felt was so iconic. And we patterned our zombies for the series of The Walking Dead after that zombie. We patterned both in terms of this kind of gait, his speed, not only is it creepy, but it just seems like it's unrelenting, you know, it's not going to stop.
Before Night of the Living Dead, there were movies like I Walk with the Zombie. They were this sort of tribal character, very different. Now, arguably, the zombie is as important as the werewolf, but right below the vampire. He's probably the most important horror monster in the history of scary movies. All these zombies all go back to Romero. There's no movie director that's responsible for the vampire. There's no movie director that's responsible for Frankenstein. There's no movie director that's responsible for the werewolf. There's people who've made key movies of that, but those are much older characters which have this kind of literary pedigree. And while there have been undead and zombies, etc., what we know of as a zombie, the kind of the It's Alive moment of it was, you know, 1968, George Romero in Night of the Living Dead in Pittsburgh.
We were only a year past Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which had made its entire subject the shockingness of interracial marriage.
Mom, this is John.
Duck, duck,
Dr. Prentice. I'm so pleased to meet you.
I'm pleased to meet you, Mrs. Drayton.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was criticized for taking pains not to offend white moviegoers and for being out of touch with the racial storms of 1967.
And it never occurred to me that I might fall in love with a Negro.
Of Sidney Poitier's character, H. Rapp Brown, said, even George Wallace would love that nigger.
African-American heroes in the mid-60s in movies were allowed to be really smart. They weren't necessarily allowed to be aggressive or strong or tough. I mean, Poitier started to break that barrier in The Heat of the Night. The most he could do was slap a white man in the face after he is slapped in the face by that white man.
Poitier played a detective who, in this scene, dared to interrogate a rich white man.
You saw it. I saw it.
The slap was an electric moment in 1967.
Then all of a sudden, Dwayne Jones is like the lead, basically, in an all-white film. But he comes across as a very strong, focused character.
Dwayne was very upset when he had to do anything violent. He's, you know, a very sensitive kind of a guy.
And what's a really telling scene is when he slaps the woman. It's even more intense than when Sidney hits what's-his-name, and in The Heat of the Night, he really slapped her.
And particularly, you know, I'm gonna slap a white woman and then shoot a white guy, and I'm going to be in trouble.
And then when he shoots the guy, you know, he shoots the guy. I said, this is a bold black man for 1967. Very bold.
And you would never put Night of the Living Dead on the spectrum of blaxploitation and black power movies that started to happen in the late 60s and early 70s. But in a way, you know, it really precedes Shaft, it precedes Superfly, it precedes all of those movies where the African-American main character was suddenly no longer accommodationist and exceptional and polite.
He's black. He's brutal. He's boss.
But, you know, tough and empowered.
I mean, of course, we discussed it, and Dwayne, as I said, was the most sensitive among us to the racial issue and, you know, how some of that stuff might resonate when we were saying, wait, it was in the script, you know, before the guy was black. And, you know, but he was saying, yeah, but he is black now. And so you have to think about that. And as I said, I've in recent years come to the thought that maybe we should have explored the racial issue a little bit. We thought we were being really hip by not changing the script.
I think it's also what made the movie feel like it belonged to another generation. That sense of not wringing its hands and having to talk, stop for a moment as they're all being pilloried by zombies and say, you know, Ben, when I was a boy, we had a colored maid and she never worked as hard as you did for us. I mean, by not having a scene like that, it felt exciting and new. It truly did.
One great thing about Night of the Living Dead is that it doesn't resort to the cliche of like, well, everybody would put aside their differences in the face of such a big threat.
How long have you guys been down there? I could use some help up here.
That's the cellar. It's the safest place.
Which is this hokey thing that horror movies and sci-fi movies still do. That no matter, you know, how much you may differ in real life, all that's going to get cast aside because you have to fight the monster or fight the alien or whatever.
The cellar. The cellar, there's only one door, right? Just one door, that's all we have to protect. Tom and I fix it so it locks and boards from the inside. But up here, all these windows, why, we never know where they were going to hit us next. You got a point, Mr. Cooper. But down in the cellar, there's no place to run to.
Romero actually suggests that, nope, it's going to be embedded even in the way you choose to fight, even in where you choose to hide.
The cellar is the strongest place.
The cellar is a death trap.
Who you are in real life is going to absolutely affect how you treat this threat and how you see this threat.
You put people in this incredibly extreme circumstance and, you know, what kind of society do they create? And that's the heart of Night of the Living Dead.
You two can do whatever you like. I'm going back down to the cellar, and you better decide. Because I'm going to board up that door, and I'm not going to unlock it again, no matter what happens.
Some parts of the movie almost say, like, Beckett. You know, that sense of what happens when you trap people together and they just have to deal with themselves. And that being this, that sense of anticipation and absurdity, just knowing that there's no place to go.
And slowly, there's cracks in the crevices. And the hands start coming through and they're trying to get the hands out. And he shoots the guy a couple times. The guy won't die until he shoots him in the head.
Okay, kill that alien or chop off their heads.
Or what?
Or just shoot them in the brain. Because the way they work is by the brain.
You usually have to throw fire so you can save yourself or somebody else.
Then they see the news report.
It's on!
We've never had the budgets to really explore that. This is a worldwide phenomenon.
His reports, incredible as they seem.
We did it mostly with media, what they were hearing on the radio and on the TV. Otherwise, it was all the farmhouse.
The wave of murder which is sweeping the eastern third of the nation is being committed by creatures who feast upon the flesh of their victims.
Chuck Craig was an actual newsman, the guy that has most of the airtime in the movie.
First eyewitness accounts of this grisly development came from people who were understandably frightened and almost incoherent.
Wrote his own copy, read the script, and we sat around and, you know, we bullshit about the concept and what was going on.
It's hard for us here to believe what we're reporting to you, but it does seem to be a fact.
That stuff has a ring of authenticity about it because Chuck did it himself.
The kind of low-key realism of those broadcasts and of those newsrooms absolutely is intended to situate the movie in reality.
That sort of unfiltered sense of nobody spinning the news, just reporting it.
It's saying, you know, if this were happening in your town, this is what your newscast would look like.
Major contact came in a pre-dawn attack by a...
I think the newscasts that were created for Night of the Living Dead are in sync with the kind of newscast that I was seeing, my generation was seeing on television when we used to watch Morley Safer out in Vietnam and the Bush and stuff.
Vietnam was America's first televised war. And while the networks systematically downplayed the bloodshed, viewers, for the first time in TV history, got glimpses of what war was really like.
I think that the news coverage of the Vietnam War was unlike news coverage from ever before. I remember just the amount of dead.
All law enforcement agencies and the military have been organized to search out and destroy the marauding ghouls.
Particularly when you sort of said with the vigilantes getting prepared and stuff. It made me think of the stuff that I would see on the television, stuff of the Newark riots, of Watts. It was all happening then. You know, you saw National Guard on the street. You saw looting and stuff. So it all was very reminiscent of that stuff. I mean, it was obviously of those times.
I grew up in Detroit in 1967. I remember that summer being terrified. There's a famous story about a house in my neighborhood that somebody was hiding out in the house. There were a bunch of, you know, the National Guardsmen, which is, say, teenagers with guns who've probably been, like, jacked up on coffee and up for 2 days in a row. There's a guy lighting a cigarette hiding out in an attic. They thought somebody fired a gun, and hundreds of rounds of ammunition were expended on this house. But this guy wasn't killed. It's a complete miracle. I mean, they shot the house up so much, it almost took the top of it off. So to see that stuff in the movie, and also see that stuff in the movie with a black guy in it, it's like a wealth of social consciousness in filmmaking. It was so many things I don't think anybody could ever do again.
In other words, you feel that the radiation on the Venus probe is enough to cause these mutations?
There was a very high degree of radiation.
Well, just a minute. I'm not sure that that's certain at all. I don't think
big traditional institutions, whether it's the government or the army or network television, are utterly unable to be counted upon. Not only counted upon to stop it, but counted upon even to explain it. So there's this great sense of just, and this is very 1968, a great sense of the complete ineffectuality of any institution that purveys itself to you as being trustworthy.
I must disagree with these gentlemen presently until we... Until this is irrefutably proved.
Everything is being done that can be done.
I think there's one other big departure from convention, specifically from horror convention, which is that if that movie had been made 10 years earlier or even 5 years earlier, there would have been like a voodoo potion.
Combining voodoo witchery with the most advanced of medical sciences.
Or a curse, or an evil professor, or an incantation.
Genius or madman?
Romero sort of tosses that all aside. You don't ever get an official, confirmed explanation of what's happening.
God changed the rules. You know, that's the only explanation that I need. No more room in hell.
You can see what it is. You can't see why it is.
It's so indeterminate that you can't protect yourself.
And you're not given anything about why it is that would make you more comfortable watching it.
And it doesn't matter to me. It's happening. And it's probably, at least in my mythology, it's probably some sort of permanent condition. I don't know, unless we redeem ourselves somehow.
Stay tuned to the broadcasting stations in your local area for this list of rescue stations.